Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 6, Episode 30, where I broke down the first part of Detective James Doucet's trial testimony. In this episode, I spent a lot of time going through the kind of color commentary play-by-play where Colleen Barnett was playing Sandy Melgar's interrogation video and stopping it at what she found to be critical points and sort of prompting the jury to make sure that they're hearing it the way she wants them to hear it. So we have that going on this week.
And also, with the launch of the new HBO docuseries, The Case Against Anand Syed, which was also your season one case, we had a lot of listeners with questions on that, as well as the ruling that came in last week on Anand's case.
Right, so we've got a lot of information to get through. I think, Mike, as we get started, why don't we go through all the questions about season six first, and then we'll transition into the questions from season one.
Sounds good to me, Bob.
All right, let's go ahead and get started.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, starting with the Melgar case, David says, will you try to have an interview with Kathleen Zellner at any point?
I would love to, but Zellner has decided that she's not doing any interviews in this case right now, which makes perfect sense because, remember, she's actively working with the prosecution right now. We know that she's met with Barnett, with Kim Ogg, and with the appellate division at Harris County. It sounds like they've already agreed to do some testing. I have not had any personal contact with Kathleen Zellner in kind of a peripheral way I have, but she's just marching along and doing her work. And she's, as a matter of fact, there's a new episode coming out sometime soon. I guess I can't really get into all the details of it, but there's another TV show that's going to do another episode about Sandy Melgar's case. Myself and Liz Rose were both invited to be the interviewees on the show. I believe Liz is going to do an interview. For me, I would have liked to, but it's not going to work with my schedule, so I had to eventually pass. So that's coming up soon, but I know, I had asked Liz about that, if maybe they could get Zellner to talk on that show, and she said she's not doing any interviews right now.
Okay, Julie says, as I've been listening to the issue of Sandy not having tears, I'm wondering if dehydration could have played a role in that. She's been in the closet with no food or water for a very long time. Couldn't that be a contributing factor if she indeed did not have tears?
Yeah, I think that it absolutely can. There's a lot of things that could factor into that if she, in fact, didn't have any tears. Remember, it's only the people attached to law enforcement that are saying that there were no tears, like she was fake crying. And even Jennifer Martinez's original report, which is the major issue in that episode a couple of weeks ago, in her report, she says that she was hysterical, she couldn't calm down. It wasn't until trial rolled around when she all of a sudden says she was faking it all, and there were manufactured responses with no tears. But let's just say for a minute that there really were no tears. I don't think that really means anything. There are people that have medical conditions where they have tear duct issues or, and dehydration. I did a little bit of research on this. Oftentimes will contribute to someone not having any tears. And then you have to remember, too, when she got out of the closet, according to Maria and Stephanie Roberts and even Jennifer Martinez originally, she was sobbing for quite a while uncontrollably. At some point, you just run out of tears, especially if you are dehydrated. So I don't think that it proves anything one way or the other because, there's a million scenarios and what ifs you could throw at it. So if we believe that she was, in fact, in the closet for all that time, then yes, she's dehydrated. She hasn't had any water. The last thing she had was alcohol. So we would expect her to be dehydrated. But if you don't believe that, there are still factors that could contribute to her not having any tears, or the officers may just have not noticed the tears, or it's always a possibility that the detectives are lying. I mean, we have to put that out there. If we're putting it out there that it's possible that Sandy is lying and making all this up, then that same standard applies to everyone. So we also have to consider that it's possible that the police officers, who are also just human beings, could be lying too.
Tony says, I'm still not understanding how the jury bought the part about Sandy, quote, changing her story when it comes to her recounting of timelines. She would know the fact that receipts are verifiable at the Mexican restaurant and the CVS, so why would those be areas she would lie about? She understood in the interview that she would have been a suspect, so if she was a criminal mastermind, she would lie about things that wouldn't have receipts. What do you take from this, Bob?
Well, that's just the thing. There's no congruency in claiming that Sandy is criminally sophisticated enough to have staged this crime scene and tied herself up and barricaded herself into the closet. And again, you know, I've touched on this months ago, but if this crime scene was staged, it's the most brilliant staging job I've ever seen or read about. And in the fact that it was staged to look like a robbery gone bad. Meaning, oftentimes when you see staging, and in one of the textbooks I have here that I've been studying is all about staging crime scenes, you see a full commitment to, I want this to look like a robbery. So there's things tossed all over, there's things missing, but especially the thing that catches my attention is how Jim was tied. So it's staged, the scene is staged to look like Jim Melgar was almost tied up, or that he was tied up and he got out of the ropes. Because the ropes that were around him, that red rope, wasn't tied. It was this big lasso that was kind of under him and looped around him, but it wasn't tied in any way that it would restrain him. So think about the thought pattern that has to go into that to make it look like he was tied up or was about to be tied up and escaped, to where she would go through all the trouble to get the rope, tie the rope, wrap the rope around him. And keep in mind, you can tell from the lividity evidence on him when he's rolled over, the rope is actually underneath his body. It's not just, you know, there was some testimony during the blood spatter analyst Celestina Rossi's trial testimony where she made some implications that she could see maybe there was like blood transfer stains on Jim's arm, like maybe somebody had moved him. And the implication there was that maybe he was lifted forward to put the rope around his back. The problem was the rope wasn't around his back. It was under him. The tail of the rope ran about mid-thigh. I'm actually looking at the picture right now. About mid-thigh, up his leg, under his buttock, and then out toward, there was the void space between his back and the wall, and then around him. So to stage something like that, it's just, I mean, I'll just say, in my opinion, there's no way possible that staging. That's too much. I've never seen or read anything where somebody has staged something to make it look like somebody was almost tied up or that they had escaped. But if you believe that's what happened, so you're talking about an extremely high level of criminal sophistication. And that's completely incongruent with her police interview and her statements to the other officers. Like I said many times, she never helps herself. And the question here was, why would she lie about what time she went to the restaurant or which restaurant she went to? Because there's receipts to prove that. Seems like she would lie about something else. And again, that is far more evidence, pointing towards the fact that Sandy is just struggling to remember. You know, the Los Cucos things that I played in this episode was a perfect example of that. You hear her, she's trying to remember the name of the restaurant, she gives another name, and you can tell that she's thinking hard about it because Ducey actually asks another question. He's moving on, and she goes back to and says, no, it wasn't Barabos or whatever she said. It was Cucos. We went to Cucos. But he was already asking about something different at that point. So that's an indicator that she's really struggling to remember, and that was one of the items that she knew was on the tip of her tongue. It was right there at the forefront of her memory, and she wouldn't give up on it until she got the right answer. So it's not consistent at all, in my opinion, for Sandy to have been lying about the things that she ultimately supposedly lied about. She didn't lie about anything, and she never said, this happened at this particular time. She's always maintained through the entire interview that she thinks she wasn't looking at a clock. She thinks she remembers. She's guessing at the time. And that was framed as her changing her story, but that's absolutely not the case.
Ashley says, when the judge approves or denies evidence to be admissible, does that include edited video and audio or the interviews? It seemed that the video of Sandy's interview was incomplete and edited to only present the story that Barnett wanted to tell and not the full picture. You'd think that Mac and Allison Seacrest would object to the version of the recording being shown to the jury.
Yeah, so any kind of time there's a video like this, it's stipulated to prior to trial by both parties as to what parts of the video can be played. Sometimes there's an argument and there has to be a judge's ruling, and other times not. Like, for example, in this case, You know, we've seen in the video the discussions about the polygraph test, but polygraph information is inadmissible in court. So that would have been edited out of the video and the jury would have never seen the fact that Sandy didn't take a polygraph. So you didn't see Mac or Allison objecting to what was on the video because they would have stipulated to or been forced to by the judge prior to the trial to agree upon what was going to be played. Now, as far as it seeming like the video only showed parts of the interrogation that were favorable to Barnett, that's not accurate. It's just that Barnett stopped the tape at places that were favorable to her case. So what it says in the transcript, if you look on the web, actually, I don't think I got the transcript up last week because I was on the road, but we'll get it up for this week because we're continuing on with Ducey's testimony. But you look at the transcript, she'll ask a question, and then it just says in parentheses, DVD playing. And there's no time there. So it could have been playing for 10 minutes, 5 minutes, an hour. And she just let it play. And then whenever it got to a point where she thought she could drive something home to the jury, she would hit pause, make her point, ask her question, and then hit play again. So it was all there, whatever was stipulated to, whatever the edited version looked like, which I think the only thing taken out was the polygraph part. So the whole thing played. She just chose when to stop and start and draw attention to certain items.
Okay, so that's all we have for the Melgar case this week. Now let's get into the Adnan Syed case. Lauren says, what are your opinions so far on the HBO documentary? Personally, I thought it was great so far, but I want to see where it goes and what we might learn.
I'm really impressed with it so far. I think the production quality is incredible. I love what Amy Berg decided to do with the animation for Hay. For those of you that haven't seen it or don't have HBO, you know, one thing that's always been lacking in our season one case and the Adnan Syed case is really no one's ever brought Hay to life. And that's been difficult because her family has never participated in any of the media. I don't think that most of them are even in the country anymore or even speak English. So we have a couple of pictures, a couple little clips, and we've heard a little bit from friends, but that's it. It's been very difficult to shine a light on Hay, and I think the docuseries is doing an incredible job of that. It was, I think, a ballsy move for them to decide to go with the animations, but I think it was very well done. And so what they did is we learn a lot about Hay by voiceovers. They had a voice actress who seems to have a bit of an Asian accent. I'm sure that was done purposefully. Reading excerpts from Hay's diary, and as this voice actress is reading the excerpts, there's animations in the diary itself as far as like the words as they're going onto the pages. And then we have this, like, I don't want to say cartoon because it sounds disrespectful, but it's basically a cartoon, an animation like that of Hay kind of acting out the things that are being spoken about in the diary. And I would say of the hour, I would say a good 40 minutes of this first episode was dedicated to helping us understand who Hay was a lot better. And, you know, I've learned some new information that I didn't know during this first episode. And, you know, so far, I can't wait to see episodes 2, 3, and 4. And to give you guys a little heads up, we actually have an interview scheduled with Colin Miller where we're going to talk about the ruling that happened a few days ago, or actually is today when you're hearing this, a week ago today, in Adnan's case, and a little bit about the docuseries. That's not going to air for a couple weeks when I'm actually on vacation in the midst of all this travel was my vacation, and I'm not going to be in a place where I can record a follow-up. So that's coming soon. But so far for me, the docuseries is 2 thumbs up.
Okay, and this one comes from actress Allison Sweeney. Somehow in the HBO doc, it seemed that Massey was saying the BPD knew back then that Don's alibi was his mom. But I thought that was info that came out years later. If they knew it in 2000, there's no excuses for not vetting it more thoroughly.
I'm going to be absolutely blunt and frank about this. Massey, in my opinion, is absolutely full of shit. The entirety of his involvement in this case was that he was the one that received supposedly the anonymous tip, the phone call from the Asian person implicating Adnan in Hay's murder. He wasn't, you know, it was Ritz and McGillivray that were the investigators. Massey didn't have any involvement. Beyond that, Massey has a long track record of corruption in Baltimore and lots of other cases. I suspect that he's on the show because he's the only law enforcement officer that agreed to be on the show. If you remember correctly, he was also the one that was dodging the subpoenas at Adnan's trial. They wanted him to get on the stand and they wanted to cross-examine him, Gutierrez did, about this anonymous call, and he disappeared off the face of the earth. They couldn't even find him to give him a subpoena. So I think that he's absolutely full of shit. As far as the information on Don's time card, he's definitely full of shit about that. The police, the investigators, Rich and McGillivray, that were actually working on the case that looked into Don, had no clue. The entirety of their investigation was they tried to reach him, Detective O'Shea from Baltimore County, the night Hay went missing. He tried to reach him early in the afternoon, or the early evening, I mean, and he couldn't get a hold of Don. Don finally connects with him at like 1:30 in the morning. During Don's first interview, he doesn't mention anything about being at work. During his second interview, he says that he was off work, or was supposed to be off work, but ended up covering at a different store at Hunt Valley for a friend who, of course, is never named. It doesn't appear that the officer ever asked what his name is. I know who, you know, there's only two options who those people could be, and they never looked into it any further than that. And then on February 1st, I think it was O'Shea, and I could be wrong on that, but one of the detectives called the LensCrafters, Don's home store. So remember, he said he was working at Hunt Valley that day, but they called the Owings Mills store, and the manager answers, and you know, they said, was he working that day? She says, let me look. She gives him times off of a time card where Don was working that day, and that was it. They dropped it. There was never any information that the manager of the Hunt Valley store was Don's mom. And as I revealed in season one, spoiler alert, bump forward 30 seconds if you don't want a spoiler, they definitely didn't know that the manager they did speak to that gave him that alibi from Owings Mills was Don's mom's domestic partner, basically Don's stepmom. They didn't know any of that at the time. So for him to imply that Don was thoroughly investigated, believe you me, or whatever he said, is just an absolute crock of shit. They weren't. And if he was investigated, then we're dealing with some possible Brady material here, because there's certainly nothing in the police files to indicate that that ever happened.
Emily says, did anyone look into the sexual abuse of Hay as a possible motive? Specifically, did that person live in the U.S. and have an alibi?
To be honest with you, the alleged sexual abuse of Hay was news to me. I've never heard that before. And you know, we only got a little piecemeal bit about it in the docuseries, so I don't think so. I mean, the police never, they didn't do the typical concentric circles of investigation, you know, where you would start with Hay's family and work your way out. I mean, they started with her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, but never her family. So there's not much information out there on that. I don't know. I have no idea. I was pretty blown away by that. And I'm curious if the investigators went any further with it.
Jason says, why has no one addressed or talked about the second day that Don falsified his time card? It was the Saturday after the winter storm, which I believe was the day he moved Hay from where he had had her after he killed her. Saturday was the first opportunity he had to move her because of all the ice on Thursday and Friday.
Well, first of all, I would say when Don allegedly changed his time card, but so for those of you that aren't aware, again, spoiler alert, might want to scoot forward a couple minutes here if you haven't listened to season one and you're planning on it. But you know, there's obviously issues with Don's time card. LensCrafters presented one to the prosecution in October, right before trial. And in that one, it showed that Don wasn't working on the day Hay went missing. And then they produced a second one that showed he was working, and that one had a different employee ID number. Most of you that know the season know the story there, but there's a whole lot of reasons to believe that that time card is false or had been falsified. As a matter of fact, the exact words that Luxottica, which is LensCrafters parent company, said to me was, if you're looking at a time card, two time cards for the same person in the same pay period, and they have two different employee ID numbers, one of them's been falsified. However, there's a lot of different ways that could have happened. You know, it could have been someone else's time card, right? So it could have been someone else and they just changed the name on it. There's a lot of different ways that that could have happened. And of course, I don't know. I've never spoken with, you know, anybody, the developers who which I'm sure I'll get into in a minute here, but the developer, the software that was being used back then. But the second timesheet shows that Don was working on the day he went missing, and he was also working on Saturday morning, which seems to be an innocuous time, but as this listener mentioned, maybe not, because based on the lividity evidence, we know that Hay was placed somewhere and then moved. Now, that could have been 10 hours later, or it could have been days later, so that is a possibility. But I don't know. What I do know is I think we did time test. It's nearly impossible for, because he had on both of his timesheets, they both showed that he was working Saturday at two different stores. And if memory serves, it was like 23 minutes apart from when he clocked out of store one and clocked into store two. And timing-wise, it seems like it would be impossible for him to have done that, made that drive, and clocked back in at the time that he did. So I don't know. I'm sure there's going to be more on it. If there isn't more in the docuseries, I'm going to dig a little further. I've been really... So full disclosure, I've known that this docuseries was going to be happening since 2016. I've actually consulted a little bit with the private investigators as well as with Amy Berg. And at one point I was going to be a part of it, and then that ended up not happening. So because of that, it's one of the reasons I've been kind of backing off this investigation for the last couple of years, because they had seemingly some really good private investigators working on the case, and I didn't want to get in the way of the work that they were doing.
All right, Bob, speaking of time cards, there was an article published in the Wall Street Journal this past week, and then also an interesting post on Reddit. Can you cover these items with the listeners?
So since the first episode of the docuseries went live on Sunday, there's been some developments. The first one, we'll talk about it. It really took me off guard. I actually posted about it on the fan page, so if you're there, you've been a part of this conversation already. But the investigators that were doing the investigation for the TV series did like an op-ed with the Wall Street Journal, which is just that in and of itself was pretty bizarre to me. You know, as far as, you know, I've had a little bit of experience working in the TV industry and know that typically networks want to keep everything under wraps. You know, they want to kind of hide the ball, because especially in an active investigation show like this, because they want to have that big reveal. They don't want spoilers. So I'm not sure how this came about to begin with, but somehow these investigators did this op-ed and they're talking about how they investigated the case and some of the things they found. I mean, they definitely, you know, were holding some things back, but they were also giving a lot away. But what really caught my attention in the article was a segment where they talked about Don's time cards. And to be honest with you, I kind of took it as a little bit of a jab, because they said something along the lines of, remember what it said, either amateur sleuth or armchair
internet armchair sleuth or something like that.
Yeah. And it says, you know, people have this theory about Don's time cards that they've been falsified by his mother. And then it goes on to say that it says that we've spoken to 15 current and former employees of LensCrafters and Luxottica, and even talked to the developer of the software that was using to track time back then. And we have debunked the time card theory. Which, of course, was really shocking to me, because I spoke with over 20 LensCrafters employees. For those of you that listen to season one, then you don't have to take my word for it. I even had a lady who was a manager at LensCrafters in 1999 come on the show and explain the system. And she explained very clearly, as did literally 100% of the people that I've spoken to. And she explained that the managers could always go into the system and change people's time. So, because you have to. Think about if you've ever worked in any place where you had to log into a computer. Say you come in, you start working, and you forgot to punch in that day. Well, the manager has to have the ability to go back in and add your time in there so you still get paid for the time when you were at work. Now, what it said in this article was that according to the software developer, there's no way that you could retroactively make these changes. And I believe the exact words were without leaving a trace. And my opinion is that I agree with that. I'm certain they'll leave a trace. That's why I've been trying to get somebody to file a fucking subpoena to Luxottica or LensCrafters to try to get access to that information, because I believe it would have left a trace. Meaning, we have this extra timesheet. We see that it has Don's name on it, but a different employee ID number. There's all the issues that we've talked about before that make it appear as though it's not a legit time card, but you could answer those questions in a lot of ways. They should be able to go into that system. And the person I spoke to at Luxottica said they still had access to those records at that time. That was 4 years ago, but they could go into that system and see when were those times entered. So it would leave a trace. The problem is nobody ever looked for that trace. The only thing that's ever been looked at is the actual timesheet, just a printed out version of Don's times for that week. So if there's a trace to be found, someone has to go looking for the trace. As far as I know, I don't know what this guy said. I didn't speak to the developer, but I absolutely disagree with, and I guess I'll make this statement, and I'm not throwing any shade at anybody, but I guess I'll defend myself here. I think it's bullshit. I don't think they properly, and if that's the conclusion they came to, I don't think they investigated it properly. And I say that, and some of that leads into this Reddit post. Someone the day after the docuseries aired surfaced on Reddit, which anybody's ever been on Reddit, it's the wrong place to go if you want to have a good conversation about this case. It's mostly full of people who believe Anand's guilty, and they can be pretty vicious. And so this guy comes onto Reddit and says, hey, they showed a picture of Don and the whole crew at LensCrafters. I'm watching the series, and I said, holy shit, that's me in that picture. I'm in that picture. And he went on to say that he thinks that he might have been the one that Don was supposedly covering for because he worked at Hunt Valley, but there's no way that he would have covered for him on a weekday because he only worked weekdays. He had some sort of court restrictions where he couldn't work on the weekends. So if he worked on a weekend, instead of trying to get the time off and hurting his relationship with his employer, he would have, you know, somebody cover his shift for him so he could stay on the schedule that way. But anyway, this guy just got attacked on Reddit, of course, which is exactly what anyone would expect to happen in that place. Nobody believed him. This was a hoax. Well, I actually reached out to the gentleman, and I spent an entire evening messaging back and forth with him. I spent a lot of that time vetting him, and so just for that matter, I can confirm with 100% surety that this is not a hoax. This man is in that picture. He did know Don, and he did work at LensCrafters at that time. He was on the schedule at that time, and that was confirmed through multiple different sources and multiple different ways, even to the point of him sending me a selfie to compare to the 1999 photo. It is absolutely him. But while I was speaking with him, I was asking about the timesheets and asked again, and I got the same answer I got from every other person I've spoken to, which is no, because he said he worked at two different stores. He would bounce back and forth between Owings Mills and LensCrafters if they needed somebody to fill in over there. And he said there should be even more of a trace because not only would you use your employee ID number to log in no matter which store you were at, just like I've been told before, but also in the lab, which Don was a lab tech, at the end of the day, you had to file a lab report and you signed them with your signature and your employee ID number. So he said there's just no way somebody would just, for some reason, use a different ID number. That number's burned into your head. It is your identifier. It's how you get paid. It's how they track your reports. You have to write it. Every single report you write, you have to put it on there. Every time you clock in, every time you clock out, you have to use it constantly. No matter which store you're at, your end of the day lab reports, you have to put it on there. So again, confirmed. And the other thing that really honestly pisses me off a little bit about the way that op-ed was done by these investigators is, I've spoken to them in 2000. I believe it was 2017, about 2 years ago. I actually got on a conference call with those investigators to talk about the time card situation. And I turned over to them everything I had on the subject. And I knew this was for the docuseries. They were working on it. But when I say that, there was a lot more that you guys didn't hear on the podcast because people didn't necessarily want to be on the record, but they were sharing things with me. I mean, I sent them screenshots and emails. Everything that I had, that even, like I said, even stuff that you guys haven't seen. So I know for a fact they have it all. One of the people that I spoke to, he's actually passed away since then, was the lab manager, Don's boss at the Hunt Valley store, Charles Kerbeam. I spoke with him, and we had a long Facebook message conversations back and forth, and he confirmed the exact same thing. He worked. There's no question. I'm looking at the picture right now where he's sitting next to Don or standing next to Don. That he was the immediate supervisor. His timesheet was included in the production from LensCrafters to the prosecution. There's absolutely no question that he knows that system. He was the lab manager. He was one of the bosses. And he also confirmed you had one employee ID number. That's what you used to clock in with, even when you bounce back and forth from store to store, period. That's it. There's no. And when I asked him, and again, these investigators have this information. When I asked him, can you think of any innocuous reason whatsoever, any reason at all, why an employee would have two different ID numbers, why they might use one ID number at one store and another number in the other store. And he said, I cannot think of any reason that makes zero sense. So now I don't know where they're going with the docuseries. I kind of suspect they're not going to talk much about the time cards anymore because these investigators talked to the Wall Street Journal about this. You know, that I can't believe that they would, you know, whether they were going to debunk the theory or confirm the theory. Either way, I don't think they would want the investigators, you know, to talking to an international publication like that and giving that information away. But I will say from my perspective, it definitely jarred me, and it caused me to do a lot of research back into season one that I had to really dig to find all my documents and paperwork from it, because it's been so long since I've done anything with the case. But after doing that, and now reaching out to new witnesses, and now speaking to this person who actually knows Don personally, or knew him personally, and worked side by side with him, I will double down 100%. That time card was falsified, and I do not believe that it has been debunked. I do not believe that the software available in 99 would have tracked that information. I do believe it would leave a trace, but not with the limited documentation that we have available to us. And as far as the gentleman from Reddit that worked with Don, I'm speaking to him primarily off the record right now. He's a good guy. He's trying to help. He's a little conflicted about whether or not he wants to get involved and do an interview right now, because there's reasons why that he's concerned about that. So I'm hoping, if he's willing to, I will absolutely do an interview with him, and you will all get to hear it. But there are, as I said, legitimate reasons why he may choose not to do that. And if that's the case, I'm hoping they'll be able to share some of the information that he's given me. And I'll tell you up front that, you know, he's not, doesn't have any information to implicate that Don killed Hay. I want to make that clear, so nobody's thinking that he's telling me Don confessed or he knows something. It's nothing like that, but he does add some valuable insight to the situation.
Kathy says, I'm curious if Don ever said that he thought Adnan was guilty. Do you know if he ever did anything to try to find Hay or look for her killer once she was found?
No, Don has just stayed off the radar for the most part, even back then in the original investigation. He's never, as a matter of fact, when he testified at trial, if memory serves, when he was asked about Adnan, because remember, they had met the day Hay had the little car accident or a car broke down, and he said he just seemed like a good guy. He didn't say anything negative about Adnan, but at the same time, no, he never, after Hay went missing, he never paged her, he never called. You know, the same things they're saying about Adnan was also true of Don, her current boyfriend, that he never paged her, he never called her, he's never, to my knowledge, made any effort whatsoever to find her. And then, of course, in this new docuseries, we find out that while she's missing and continuing on after Hay's body was found, Don was pursuing one of her good friends, Debbie Warren, romantically. So that throws a little twist in everything, too.
Jasmine says, Hay's brother says he accidentally called Adnan on that day, the day she went missing. He said he thought he was calling Don at trial, but Adnan picked up. Do we know what they discussed?
You know, I did one time. I think that, and I'm strictly drawing from memory right now. I mean, I haven't actively investigated this case in about 3 years. But so what had happened was, when Hay didn't show up at the early learning center to pick up her cousin, everyone started to get worried. They were panicking. They called the police. It wasn't like her. She wasn't answering her pages. And Young, her brother, I believe, went and looked at her diary. In the last page of her diary was where she wrote Don 127 times, and it was all over the page. And if you remember back from season one, my episode Conflicted, I got into that a little bit, and I have what I think is a pretty interesting analysis of that part of the diary, because we have Don written over and over and over and over and over again. And then at the bottom of the page, it says, I miss my baby, or something to that extent, which I found interesting because she always referred, throughout the entire diary, she always referred to Adnan as her baby. And I never saw anywhere where she called Don her baby. So that's just a little point of reference there. And we also do know from the phone records that Adnan called her that night and gave her his new cell phone number, because he had just gotten his cell phone that day. And she wrote his cell phone number on that page. So you have this last page of the diary with 127 Dons written in it. And I believe it was down at the bottom. It says, I miss my baby. And then at the top, it has Adnan's number written in there. Well, so Young looks at the diary, sees Don written over and over and over again, and a phone number. So that's why when he called it, he thought he was calling Don, because he assumed that was Don's phone number. In actuality, we find that it was back months before. It may have been December or maybe before that. I have to go back to my notes, but that Hay had written Don's actual phone number in the diary back then. But I think that Young just called Adnan asking if he'd seen Hay, and I think that Adnan answered and said, just know that he hadn't. And I think that that's when he said that, you know, Hay's going to be in trouble. He wasn't worried she was missing. He was worried that she was just going to be in trouble. But again, I'm really working off memory right now, and I'm kind of second guessing that, but that's the best. That's what I remember.
Nicole says, does anyone know the nature of Don's disability? He's been disabled since he was 23, which would be right around the time of Hayes' murder. Is that a physical disability that affected his mobility and possibly provide reason that he was not able to commit Hayes' murder?
I do know what his disability is, and I'm not going to share it because it's none of your business. It's none of anybody's business. It's really none of mine either. But I do know the nature of it, and the answer to the question is no. In 1999, it would not have affected his ability to do anything physically, as far as I'm aware. And speaking of him physically, did anybody else notice? I'm asking a question you guys can't answer, but when they showed the picture of Don at LensCrafters, I have to admit, I was shocked. So I've never shared it, but other people have, the picture of Don from his high school yearbook, which, you know, we were all always like, you know, why is Hay describing him as this like blonde-haired, blue-eyed, Zach Morris type guy? When you look at his high school yearbook picture, and he was, at that time, he was overweight. He looked, I don't know, what we would call now goth or emo. He was dressed in black, his slicked black hair, just nothing like what Hay was describing. So it was interesting to see his photo at LensCrafters. It was a couple years later where he really does. He's a good looking guy in that picture. If I can say that, I guess I shouldn't be really judging anybody's looks, but much closer to what Hay was describing. He looks like he lost quite a bit of weight. He's changed his hairstyle. Now this photo, I did find out from the gentleman who was posting on Reddit, that photo that was put up on the documentary with the whole team from LensCrafters and Don, that was from well before Hay went missing and was killed. And we know that because of the woman who's in the front of that picture standing in front of Don. Her name is Ingrid, and she was the manager at Hunt Valley before Don's mom took over as manager. Because in that picture, he also has brown hair, so it's a little confusing as to why Hay would say he was blonde-haired. Because he definitely did have dark hair, but I would assume that by 99, he had, you know, remember, we're talking about the late 90s, so he likely had frosted or dyed his hair in 99. But it was just interesting to me to see that, you know, this image I had and the thing of why was Hay with this guy? And not that looks matter all that much, but she just had a very different perception of him from reality about what he actually looked like. Until I see the more recent pictures of him from that time, and he definitely completely had changed his looks by then.
Victoria says, is there any known connection between Jay and Don? Also, is there a reason Don could have any sort of power over Jay and therefore use him to lie?
No, I don't think so. I've never seen any connection between Jay and Don, and as I've stated publicly many times, I actually don't think Jay had anything to do with this, and I don't think that Jay has any actual knowledge of Hayes' murder. And you know, you have to listen to season one or listen to Undisclosed to hear all the reasons why. But I think a connection between Don and Jay would be irrelevant because I don't think Jay has a clue what actually happened.
Sarah says, has there ever been any evidence linking Jay with Alonzo Sellers?
Same story. I don't think that Jay knows what's going on. I don't think he knows what happened. And back in 2015, when I was investigating this case, I was never able to find any connection there.
Lena writes, did I miss something between Debbie and Don? For some reason, I didn't know they had a thing after their 7-hour conversation. Also, did anyone notice when she started talking about him how her attitude changed? It seemed like she got all flirty with the way she was telling her story.
Debbie is, I don't know, I find her interesting. I think that, how do I say this? I don't think we're getting the whole truth out of Debbie. You know, you see her as her seeming a little bit flirty or whatever the way she was talking. Remember, for those of you that don't remember, I've met Debbie. We were both on the Grace versus Abram show on the same panel together last year. So I got to spend several hours with her and talk to her quite a bit in the breaks and also see what she was saying during the panel discussion. And I don't know, there's something more there, I believe, than she's letting be known. I've seen kind of stories but seem to shift, maybe change a little bit. The nature of her relationship with Don, who she calls Donnie on the stand at trial. I don't know. It was strange. If you haven't watched that episode, I don't know if there's any way to access it, but it was on Grace versus Abrams. I think there was only 6 or 7 episodes. The one on this case, you'll see my interactions that made the final cut with her, where she's saying that she thinks Adnan did it because no one else had a motive or opportunity, But then when you questioned her on specifics, or when I questioned her on specifics, like, you know, when she says, you know, how would anybody get a hold of her? What if, you know, somebody must have got her in the parking lot or blah, even though she was the last person to see Hay and saw her leave alone with it not going the other direction. And the last thing she said, the last thing Hay said to Debbie was, I'm going to go see Don. So, and I'd asked her, and I think that did make the final cut, if I remember correctly, of the episode. Do you think maybe it's possible she just went and did, you know, Occam's razor, she went and did exactly what she said she was going to do? And by the way, that's something else that goes against the Don time card thing. Don says he was working till 6 o'clock that night, and let's forget about the fact that there was no 9-to-6 shift in the lab that day or ever during the week at LensCrafters. But Hay says she's leaving school at 3 o'clock or 2:15 to go see Don. Why would she be doing that if Don was working that day? So that's something else to think about too. But yeah, I don't know about Debbie. I don't want to say anything bad about Debbie. I think I'm sure she's a great person. I feel like there's something more to her than we're seeing. And that could be intentional, it could be unintentional, I don't know. But just that's just my gut feeling and the fact that I've seen some story shift a little bit from what she said to the police to what she said at trial to what she said to me, what she said on the Grace vs. Abrams show to now what she's saying in the HBO docuseries. There's something's missing there.
Kelly says, where does the fax cover sheet ruling fall in all of this? If I remember correctly, the way it was worded was if it was there and the state didn't turn it over to the defense, that is a Brady violation. If it was turned over, then it was ineffective assistance of counsel of Gutierrez not to ask the cell phone expert about the reliability of inbound calls. I thought this made it a slam dunk, since either way it favors Adnan.
It does favor Adnan, and in fact, that is actually what Judge Welsh overturned the guilty verdict on. It wasn't based on Asia, it was based on the cell tower evidence. But then the issue is now that the highest court in Maryland that just issued the ruling to reinstate the conviction, they actually did not challenge at all Judge Welsh's factual findings on that. They did find that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for Christina Gutierrez to not cross-examine properly the cell tower witness. They didn't find a Brady violation. I guess they couldn't prove that the state didn't turn that fax cover sheet over, I think is how that went down. But the issue wasn't what that evidence meant. In fact, all the court's rulings were that the cell tower evidence was the crux of the state case, that by not attacking that evidence and allowing that lie, that misinformation to go into trial, directly impacted the outcome of the trial. So that's not the issue. The issue is the judges in this final court, four of them anyway, four out of the seven, interpreted the law to state that Adnan could not raise the cell tower issues on a technicality because in his initial post-conviction appeal, even though we didn't know, and Adnan didn't know about the cell tower issue back then, and there's no way he could have known, he didn't raise it as part of his appeal. Now, Judge Welch determined that because that was new information to Adnan, there's no way that he could have understood it back then, even if it was accessible because he was, you know, he never finished high school, so on and so forth. It was considered new evidence, and therefore he allowed the argument to be made and then made his ruling based on it. What the higher court has said is something to the extent of that only applies if it's a new claim. And so this is one claim, ineffective assistance of counsel, and then we have multiple reasons for the claim. And what you can't do, they're saying, their ruling indicates that what you can't do is add more reasons to an already existing claim. So if this was new evidence that there was a Brady violation, he could bring that even though it wasn't filed originally because it's new. But because this is just another part of an IAC claim, it's time barred or he's waived his right is what the ruling is.
Eleanor says, someone posted on the group yesterday an excerpt saying Don assaulted Debbie. Do we have any more information on what happened? Was it before or after Hay's death?
So that's another thing with Debbie, and that's one of the things I asked her about when I was with her in New York at the Grace vs. Abrams show. And I don't know. In the police notes, it says that friends don't like, or girlfriends don't like new boyfriend, and Don assaulted Debbie, or new boyfriend assaulted Debbie. I don't remember exactly what it said. But one of those two things, and when I asked her about it, she said, I don't know. I don't remember ever saying anything like that. And to be honest with you, I guess I'm not going to go there with it. I'm just going to I don't know. There's a reason. There has to be a reason that was in the report. I do have a little bit of other information about that, not specifically an assault, from some peripheral people that were around Don and Debbie. I don't know. I'll say that's part of the reason, her saying that she doesn't know why that's in there and she doesn't have a clue about it. I guess I'll just say this. I don't believe that. At least I don't believe that she didn't know about it at the time. Maybe she's forgotten since then, but I just don't buy that at all.
Cormick says, do you have any thoughts about the revelation that the, quote, Asian caller sounded Southeast Asian and was most likely Korean, and hence probably not Pakistani or South Asian, as most people had probably assumed previously?
That's just another example of me thinking that Massey is full of shit. So, this is an anonymous caller. Think about this. He takes a call from an anonymous caller, and then he writes down that this is an Asian male, and I don't remember if he put, you know, teenager or late teens, early 20s, how he wrote it, but he had an age and that it was an Asian male. And then now, 20 years later, he's saying it specifically, it was an Asian male, and it sounded like a, probably Korean. Like, what the hell does that mean? Is he, I don't know, maybe he's a linguistics expert, maybe he knows a lot about different dialects. I don't know, but there's no way. If the call, and that's one of the, I go back to, did the call ever even actually happen? Did he add more to it? I don't know. I think Massey's full of shit is the answer to that question.
All right, and our last question comes from John. What exactly is the next step in the current process still available that will allow uncovered information to be shared that could exonerate Adnan?
There's a lot of steps, and as I mentioned, we're going to have an interview coming up. It'll be 2 weeks from today with Colin Miller, where he's going to explain all of that. Reader's Digest version. At any time, Maryland is similar to Texas and other states where I've worked, that anytime you can come up with new evidence, if there's new, and remember these words, I've said them many times, new and compelling evidence that exonerates Adnan or implicates someone else, you can always reopen the case and claim a writ of actual innocence and ask for a hearing on that. So say we found DNA that points to some serial killer, you know, who is the one guy, the Roy Davis, I think is the man that killed Jada Lambert. Say we find his DNA under Hayes' fingernails and it had never been tested before. That's new and compelling evidence that could be presented immediately to the court with a writ of actual innocence because we can prove who actually committed the murders. And we can prove that it was, in fact, not Adnan. So there's lots of avenues left. I'm not going to try to articulate and explain them because I'm just not good at it, at least not nearly as good at it as the great Colin Miller, who, after speaking with him the other day, I will be referring to as One Take Colin.
One Take Colin.
He is a machine. He never misspeaks ever. It's very impressive. But anyway, that's coming up. Is that it, Mike?
That's going to do it, Bob.
Okay. Thank you all for, again, putting up with our travel schedule. We're trying to keep things on pace for you. I know this week, right now, we're going to have, as of now, unless something changes, on Sunday, we're going to have the second part of Detective Doucet's testimony. I think you're all going to find it really interesting. And if you hadn't listened to last week's, listen to it. It's not reading trial transcripts. There's a lot of really good information in there. And I dig into a little bit of analysis about some behavioral things and linguistic things that I think you'll all find interesting. That's going to continue this Sunday with part two. It's looking like there's probably going to be a third part to Doucet's trial testimony, which is starting to take it. We're almost there, folks. It's starting to take us to the tail end of my travels to where we'll be back in the studio and everything will be normal. With that being said, the reason I said that, you know, as of right now, that's a plan. As I mentioned, this coworker of Don's I'm speaking to, he may agree to do an interview. If he does, I'm going to get that in and get it out to you all as soon as possible. So we may, back like in the old days, we may bounce from season six back into season one for a little bit and then back into six. But we need to, you know, this. All of these are active investigations. Adnan's case has been reactivated with this docuseries. So, and then I'm still trying to get an interview with the victims from the Kingwood home invasion and Sandy's case. One way or another, there will be an episode coming up on that. She gave me as all the information I needed. I just asked her to come back on and basically tell me again so you could hear it straight from her mouth. So if she decides not to do that, then we will still have that coming up. But if she decides to do that, that'll be coming in very soon too. Several other interviews we're working on. So There is a lot going on in the NBI studios in these next several weeks, and I will not be in the studios during any of it. So we'll be working on the road, but we have our travel studio that's going with me, so we should be able to do whatever we need to do to keep the ball moving forward in all these cases over the next several weeks. And with all that being said, my long-winded butt is going to shut up, and hope you guys enjoy the episode on Tuesday, and we'll talk again next Friday.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Mike Bussing is our executive producer, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Thank you to Amanda Meyer with Willow Photo and Design for designing and creating our Friday follow-up logo. And all of our font across all of our logos and banners was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our transcription team, Rachel Timberman, Natalie Alicia, Pamela Westby, Katherine Christman, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. And if you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter. The show's handle is @TruthJusticePod, and my personal Twitter handle is @BobRuffTruth. And for more personal interactions, feel free to follow me on Instagram @TruthJusticePod. Don't forget, we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Seen the film. You know the game. Now, Jumanji just got real. Only at Chessington World of Adventures. Featuring Daredevil Dad, Mom on a mission, and the kids who can't wait to ride the world's first Jumanji roller coaster. An epic adventure awaits. World of Jumanji. Only at Chessington World of Adventures. Book this summer's must-do day out at Chessington.com.